Greetings and welcome to The Dividing Line. It is Tuesday, September 11th, 2018, and you know, I was literally less than 100 meters from where I sit right now on September 11th. Michael Fallon had woken me up and called me from Florida. Of course, they're 3 hours ahead of us. To let me know what was happening that day at the World Trade Center and other places. So I turned on the television, began watching, and went and got my kids up and said, you need to be watching this. And eventually we had to get cleaned up. It was the first day of school. And it was the 1 year that I taught at a Christian high school. And so it was first day of class, and I remember walking into that class and telling those students, your lives and your futures, change today in ways that, you have no way of knowing. And it's interesting, at least one of those young people in that class, with whom I butted heads more than once, eventually ended up in the United States Marines as a bomb disposal expert and numerous tours overseas, which probably would not have happened were it not for 9/11. And I heard something that stunned me. Just a little while ago on television, one of the reporters talking about it said that a quarter of Americans alive today were not old enough, or either alive or old enough to know what was going on. So basically you're 20-year-olds and below when 9/11 took place. A quarter. Wow. I cannot imagine what it would be like for 9/11 to have been something before your knowledge of it. You know, it was a completely, certainly in the travel industry, it was a completely different world. Traveling there, believe it or not, there was a time when travel was fun and people smiled and, you know, before 9/11, for example, people could, meet you at the gate. There were a couple times when my wife brought the kids to meet me when I was coming back from a trip, and right there is to get off the plane, right there at the gate. They'd meet you, and you'd frequently have to dodge through all the people that had stopped and meeting loved ones and stuff like that. Now that happens outside security, you know, so it still happens, just happens someplace else. And and of course that TSA line and all that wonderful, fun stuff we get to do today, you didn't do back in the 70s and 80s and 90s and so on and so forth. Yeah, a lot of stuff has changed, but it's amazing to think of how many people today do not remember that that amazing morning, and then, of course, watching the towers collapse and. Something else. Time. I wonder what is being planned for the 20th anniversary when that comes up. That'll probably be fairly big. You know, Flight 93 and everything that happened with that. Fascinating stuff. But every year you think back on it, and then we move on. My daughter mentioned being woken up that morning. I was 12. My dad woke me up and said, you need to come see what's happening. And so it's interesting what they remember from that far back. But fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. By the way, Summer and Joy had Tom Askell on their program. So this week's Sheologians broadcast. They're interviewing Tom Askell about the statement on social justice and the gospel. I'll mention this a little bit later, but I was listening this morning to Jamar Tisby and his crew talking about the statement, and it's an illustration of how far apart the two sides are, that there was a lengthy discussion of the title and the fact that it's the statement rather than a statement. So if, since it's the statement, that's an exercise of power and oppression rather than a statement. Who knew? Don't even know how to respond to something like that. It obviously has nothing to do with power at all. But if that's all you think about, that's the only categories you have to look at the world in. Everything's power and oppression and all the rest of that stuff. Then I guess you see it everywhere. You just see it everywhere. Whether it's there or not, you see it. And that's the problem. I just don't even know how to deal with that. But anyway, on other issues, there is an article that Bob Gagnon referred to, talking about Donald Sweeting, president of the 8,000 student Colorado Christian University, spoke during a public hearing for the negotiated rulemaking committee of the U.S. Department of Education on Thursday to comment on changes that could negatively impact religious freedom. I have been saying for an extended time that the issue of accreditation will be the issue that is utilized to end specifically faithful Christian education in the West, and specifically the United States. It's not a big deal in Europe because they've dealt with it in other ways, doing the same thing. But fundamentally, if this is, I say this to every university, every seminary, if you take government money, Caesar will tell you what you can and cannot teach. And it's just a matter of election cycles until we have these same bureaucrats absolutely demanding that every Christian institution of education join in, not tolerate, not just put up with, but join in the celebration of the immoral revolution. So homosexuality and transgenderism and the profaning of marriage and it'll just keep going from there, because there's no stopping point on this slope. It just goes all the way down. That is going to be used. And so if, you know, so many of these schools are absolutely dependent upon Pell Grants, upon the government handout. And there are a couple schools already that have said, nope, not going to do it. They see it coming. They're smart. They've already fixed things, made things so that their students got to find other ways to pay their bills rather than Caesar's money. But that doesn't change the accreditation issues in the sense of utilizing that baseball bat to beat people over the head. And so evidently this article is about fundamentally changing the language that so as to allow for the insistence upon LGBTQ compliance with the current societal advancement in the immoral revolution. And religious schools and so on, so forth, doesn't matter. You have to bow the knee to Caesar, and Caesar says thou shalt celebrate people who are confused sexually and act upon those confusions. It's coming. I look it up. It's there. What can I say? Let me see here. Just looking at how I want to approach this. Like, could I say something about two sort of off-topic things that just have been bugging me like anything. One just may be a age thing, but I'm old enough to remember the queen of women's tennis, Chrissy Everett. Remember Chrissy Everett? Chrissy Everett was a cute little thing, but she looked like she looked like Princess Diana a little bit, you know? Yeah. Very classy lady, always classy in victory or defeat, either one. Very talented. And such a contrast to John McEnroe. I think they were active. I think she was a little bit before McEnroe, but I think there was crossover time. Yeah. So I think he was a little bit after she had retired too, and he's still playing. I mean, he's playing the senior circuit now. He's going to die with a racket in his hand. But when I think of her Wimbledon wins and US Open wins and stuff like that, different world. What happened this past weekend? I don't know if you saw the debacle at the US Open. It just really bugged me. It really, to me, said a lot, well, about fans in New York, but more so the USTA, the whole nine yards. What was done to the young lady who is the US Open champion? I think she's all of 21 years old. Naomi Osaka, I think. I don't have it in front of me, but who had beaten Serena Williams earlier in the year. So this is the second time she's defeated her. Between the outrageous behavior on the court by Serena Williams and then the treatment by the fans and even the USTA officials of the champion, she's crying when she receives her trophy. She's having to apologize for having beaten the one who was supposed to win. It was just stunning. Something like that could never have happened only a matter of a few decades ago. It would have been a scandal on an unbelievable level. And yet now we have people actually talking about women's rights and racism and everything else in regard. Have you noticed that Naomi Osaka is not Anglo? I mean, the whole paradigm just falls apart here. You have one minority beating another minority. It has nothing to do with any of that stuff. And it was a girl to beat the girl, the woman to beat the woman. I mean, the whole thing is just so insane and so disgusting. I wish there was some way that the entire nation as a whole could send a huge apology card to Naomi Osaka and say, "We are so sorry for the jerks that were booing you for having won." I mean, some of us actually know what sportsmanship is, and evidently those people who can afford those tickets didn't get that memo. Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. So there was that. And then sort of similar to that, I had some back and forth, some people in social media today about the Nike thing. Now, look, the main comment that I have made, I retweeted somebody else and then I got jumped on for having retweeted that. But the problem from a Christian worldview analysis perspective, to utilize someone else's language, with the Nike ad was, as I put in Twitter yesterday, modern, decrepit Western society believe something. Biblical perspective, Christian worldview perspective, and what used to be Western societal perspective. Believe the truth. It is your duty as the creature of God. Those are two very different things. And all the memes that people have been cranking out, just mocking the philosophical, theological worldview collapse of that ad campaign, many of them have been quite quite humorous. It's easy to mock that kind of language because it doesn't make any sense. Believe something. Hey, become a flat earther while you're at it. Hey, just sacrifice everything for it. Yeah, that's brilliant. You could put people from the Jim Jones cult there, and you could put the folks from Waco there. That's what you got to do. You got to get a picture of Waco burning. Believe something and be willing to sacrifice everything for it. But there you go. There's... Oh, yeah, Fred Phelps, whatever. It's just... It's pure insanity. It is a postmodern, ridiculous, empty statement. And that should be what bothers everybody. Now, I got dragged into arguing about where Kaepernick was in his career, you know, and that anybody can argue one way or the other on that. I'm sorry, but when you talk about people who've sacrificed everything, he's not the first person that comes to mind. Well, he sacrificed his career. Well, I don't really know if that's the case, but could I get the interest on his current net worth? I'd be doing real well just with the interest on his net worth. I don't get it. I don't follow it, but there you go. If I could direct your attention to two articles, that have been written, then I'm going to address a really controversial couple of biblical texts just to make you feel very, very uncomfortable. And we'll go from there. Someone that you are not allowed to read and admit that you read, by name of Douglas Wilson. Well, what had happened was an article appeared while I was in Florida, and I also need to report on the Florida trip. So I'll talk about these two articles, then I'll talk about Florida, then we'll do the biblical thing, and then I'll see where we are from there. While I was in Florida, Joel McDermott posted a rambling thing about the statement. And I'll be perfectly honest with you. Some of you say, no, you shouldn't say it. No, I'm just going to be straight up front of you. Joel McDermott tries to write like Doug Wilson, but he can't. And the result is you're sitting there going, eh? What? I was thinking about trying to respond to Joel McDermott's article, but I was just sitting there looking at it like, I don't even know where to start. You know, it's sort of like sometimes you have to move a piece of furniture in your house and you get over to it and you're like, where do you grab this thing? You know, there's just no place to grab hold of anything. It's all just fluff. And it was never designed to be moved. Once it was put in place, just leave it there. Never been moved again. And so I was very thankful when I saw that Doug Wilson had decided to respond in his own inimitable fashion. And it's a very lengthy response, as he himself apologizes for. But Doug Wilson is a wordsmith, and there are not many wordsmiths around anymore. And to be honest with you, if the educational system in the West isn't rescued from its current trajectory, I don't know if there's going to be that many people left who would be able to recognize what a wordsmith is or even appreciate wordsmithery. Reading is becoming a lost art amongst a large majority of people, and hence you can't appreciate overly well when you encounter just really well-written stuff. Both articles I'm going to refer you to here, Doug Wilson's and the second, are written by, I think, wordsmiths, people who really have the ability to use the language. I can use the language to communicate and to explain difficult concepts and things like that, but I'm not a wordsmith. I don't have that ability, the turn of phrase that many people do. I'm just too prosaic, I guess. Wilson responds to McDermott, not by quoting him a lot, but by weaving a narrative. And there was one particular, you know, there'll be entire sentences that sort of pop out at you. Let me just read you two paragraphs. This is a message of grace and nothing but grace, and it leads inexorably and necessarily to moral transformation, Romans 6:1-4. All other systems are based on works and depend for their motivation on some form of the lash. You will never be good enough, you will never be pure enough, and you will always be a misogynistic racist. You exude microaggressions. So I am not talking about trifles. All genuinely Christian social action is grounded on the rock of an absolute declaration of not guilty. Justification. Not guilty. Social justice, in scare quotes, in every form I have seen it take, drives people before it with a whip. You are guilty, you toxic male. You are guilty, white boy. You are guilty, you conservative. You are guilty, you grandchild of complacent Republicans. You are guilty, you there with a savings account. You are guilty, you descendant of slave owners. You are guilty, guilty, guilty. And though you will never be able to fix it, we might be willing, in a spirit of benevolence, to let you try. And then to try again. Welcome to the squirrel cage run of salvation by works. Paragraphs like that just reach out and grab you. This is blogs called Blog and Mayblog, Theology It Bites Back. And this title was American Vision and the Word That Justifies, dated yesterday. If you want to read the entirety of the material. Now, also yesterday, a much shorter article. if you only have time to read one, read this one. There is a young man who has, I believe his blog's called Slow to Write. He is named Samuel Say. And as my daughter would say, he's lit. She said on Twitter yesterday that his article was the most lit thing she had read today. And I, you know, as you get older, like me. Yeah, Rich says it sounds dope. Nothing like some guys in their late 50s sitting around trying to figure out how to speak like the younger generation. Because lit dope would have gotten us arrested when we were in high school. So, not in Colorado now, but when we were young people, even in Colorado, lit dope would have gotten you in trouble. So yeah, the whole thing is very difficult for me to. Yeah. The language stuff, tough for me to handle. But anyway, Summer says that Samuel Say's article is lit. So, and he said that it would make his entire week if I managed to work the word lit into the dividing line in reference to his article. So there you go. I'm not sure that he is going to appreciate the lit dope thing, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, yeah, Kofi just said, did James just use the word lit on the dividing line? The end surely is nigh. Yes, I'm sure that it is. Anyway, on the statement on socialjustice.com website under the articles, for September 10th, Samuel Say has an article called Social Justice is a Threat to Human Rights in the Gospel. Now, I highly recommend the reading of this article to you for one simple, straightforward reason. 98.5% of the verbiage being expressed on this subject right now involves equivocation and utilization, numerous violation of categories in proper thought, and the utilization of multiple definitions for the same phrases, especially for social justice. And so the primary thing is people will present a shallow case for a form of biblical justice based upon maybe the application of God's law, sort of like the Old Testament prophets, or even Deuteronomy 18, where God cast the people out of the land that were there before the Israelites because of their sins. And those sins are listed there in Deuteronomy chapter 18, which includes homosexuality and incest, things. And they were cast out. They were vomited out of the land because of that, those sins, which demonstrate then that those are universal laws. And so what you do is you get a surface level. Everyone can agree that the throne, God's throne, is founded upon justice, and God loves justice, and He does justice, and it's as if one side is saying that justice is a bad thing, which of course nobody is. So people will trot out a biblical concept when everybody knows that what the document is addressing is not biblical justice. I mean, we affirmed all sorts of categories of biblical justice in the document. Social justice is not biblical justice on pretty much any level. And if you want to see what the differences are, then, you know, people say, well, you should have defined these things in the statement. Well, it's funny, as I listen to more and more criticisms over the past, it's only been out for a week, over 7,000 signers already, which is very good for the first week. Some of those statements from like last year and stuff like that have 1,300, 1,200 signers a year later. We've got 7,000. So obviously it has resonated with a much larger audience. What? Yeah. No, don't call it the, because that's some type of expression of power. Anyway, we've been told, on the one side, you talked about way too much, and the other side didn't talk about enough. I mean, the criticisms are just, you know, it's real easy if you've never tried to write something like that. To criticize people who have, until you do it yourself. But you didn't define social justice. Well, I think we did in the denials. If you look at what is denied in the denials, you'll get a pretty good idea of what social justice is that we're talking about. But even more so, Samuel Say's article does a great job. Let me just read you a little portion of it. Over time, the term social justice became associated with critical theorists and neo-Marxists from the Frankfurt School in Germany. They rejected universal rights or human rights as a basis for justice. They essentially rejected liberty for individuals as the hallmark for justice in society. They believed instead that parity between groups were the mark of justice in society. Now, see, let me stop right there. That's nothing you ever find in Scripture. You do find parity before God in one's spiritual relationship to Him, but you do not find economic parity. Economic fairness, yes. But there is no call for the rich to become poor and the poor to become rich and all the rest of that kind of stuff. It's just not there. They believed instead that parity between groups is the mark of justice in society. They rejected individualism and embraced collectivism. Now think about it. If a society gives freedom to individuals, there are just some people that are really good at making money. And then there are other people that are not. And as a result, you're going to have disparity in how much people possess, how much they own. And that is necessary in a society that honors individual freedom, individual effort, labor, gifting, whatever it might be. What we are hearing, what we're listening to in our society today is a creeping Marxist concept that denies individualism, promotes collectivism, as a result, pretends to produce equality of result. Now, as everybody knows who's read anything about socialism and communism, it never works that way. You always have the elite. You always have people have more than others. They just become the party people, you know, the people that are in control of suppressing everybody else's rights. But that's the panacea. And our educational system no longer educates people about that. And so you've got a bunch of young people going, that sounds really great. And we're repeating it once again. I posted a cartoon. It said, it is very true that those who do not study the past are doomed to repeat it. But it is equally true that those who do study the past are doomed to sit around and watch everybody else repeat it that doesn't study history. And helplessly sit around while the past is repeated by those who don't study history. And it's true. It's just true. So anyway, they did not define justice as equality of opportunity. They defined justice as equality of outcome. This is the issue. In listening, for example, to the Witness web, the Drop the Mic webcast from The Witness, as I did a run this morning, so I listened to it on my run. And, you know, one of the things that was said was, well, why is the American evangelical church so white? To which I did not cry out while running and while breathing hard, but the thought crossed my mind, maybe because the majority of people in America are, or at least certainly have been. You know, if the African American population is like 10%, then would you expect it to be 50%? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. When you're in a minority, the majority is going to be the majority. You're going to be the minority. That's sort of obvious, isn't it? I mean, I don't understand what the objection is until you start running everything through these lenses that do not come from Scripture. And that's one of the things we were saying in the article, is that while we all have lenses, Scripture, by its very nature and its consistency, if it's handled right, can give us the mechanisms to see those lenses and to identify them, the traditions and things like that. I go on. They agreed with Karl Marx that disparities between privileged and underprivileged members of society are indicative of injustice. Not that God gives gifts to certain people. Not that it is God's will that there be people who are skilled in one area and I'm given certain gifts over here. The gifts I'm given aren't going to allow me to get $168 million NFL contracts or NBA contracts or MLB or whatever else. Do I have a ground for complaining about that? Well, in a neo-Marxist style of thought, yeah. But not from a Christian worldview. Neo-Marxism cuts out all ground of Christian contentment. When you think about how pastorally we seek to inculcate contentment with God's, with the, our lot in life and the gifts that God has given to us. Even in the midst of encouraging people to use those gifts to the uttermost and to the fullest, that's perfectly right. I want to honor God in that way. But the reality is that I've known my entire life that there are going to be people who will always have more than me. Okay, that doesn't make me unhappy. I choose not to be unhappy about that. And that's because God has his ways and wisdom. And to be honest with you, I don't want to be accountable for as much as somebody else might be accountable for in the final day. Because you're going to answer for those things. Anyway, they believe privileged members of society and underprivileged members of society make up the oppressor and the oppressed. Therefore, for them, justice, social justice, meant eliminating disparities between groups in society. They conclude that justice is when a society implements a system that produces equality of outcome for groups instead of equality of opportunity for individuals. This is why disparities between men and women and disparities between white Americans and black Americans are two of the biggest issues for social justice activists today. This is why white privilege and male privilege are two of the biggest social justice buzzwords today. And it was interesting that in listening to Drop the Mic, that one of the statements was about, look at the lack of women. These men, these brothers, are deeply influenced by this kind of thinking. Well, I don't think they recognize it. And they don't seem at all to be willing to listen to anyone pointing it out, that's for sure. But what you'll get in Samuel's article is a brief and yet very clear understanding of what the issues are. As he says, the neo-Marxist and critical theorist understanding of social justice is overwhelmingly the definition for social justice today. That is how colleges and universities define social justice. That is how my professors describe social justice to me. That is how many dictionaries define social justice. For instance, Google and the Oxford Dictionary define social justice as justice in terms of the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. End quote. So in the vast majority of instances, the problem we're experiencing that has been exposed very clearly through the releasing of this statement is that you have a large number of people utilize when social justice is discussed within the church, you define it as biblical justice. But when application is made in society, in the voting booth, it's social justice as defined within society. And that's why there wasn't a specific definition, as in just a single quote, because then everybody's going to say, oh, that's not what I believe. Unless you listen really carefully and closely, and then you discover it's at the foundation of everything they believe. Of everything they believe. So if you go to statement on socialjustice.com, articles, Samuel Say's article, social justice is a threat to human rights and the gospel. It's lit. I just wanted to make Samuel happy. Samuel, yeah, that's going to be a meme, isn't it? Yeah, that's going to be a meme right there. There's going to be memes about everything on earth being lit now. And that's just the way it is. I'm counting down the seconds until Kofi's thing appears on Twitter saying something. He said it again. So anyway, all right, let's step away from that for just a moment. And let me talk a little bit. I sort of got off track and I was going to do this toward the beginning, but let me talk a little bit about Florida. What an interesting weekend. I've only been to Jacksonville once before. And I did ask the pastor of the Switzerland Community Church, that was the church that put all this stuff together. You know what, Rich? Do you know what the poor brother's name is? Joseph Smith Jr. I mean, it's Joseph Smith Jr. And you know, we had a little discussion about name changing things and things like that. But you know, there's a lot of people today that don't know who Joseph Smith Jr. was historically. So it maybe it's not that bad, but it just makes polygamy jokes and stuff like that just way too easily, and golden Bibles and stuff like that. But anyhow, the guys there did a great job. They're a bunch of young guys. I mean, they seem to be around the age of Josh. So I was feeling energized by the time I spent with them. Oh, Skyman was born there. Well, look at that. Now, what surprises me a little bit to find out Skyman was born there is I did ask, okay, which Jackson is this city named after? Because there are politically correct Jacksons and politically incorrect Jacksons. And according to Google, hey, Google, it was named after Andrew Jackson. So Andrew Jackson, that's cool. If it was Thomas Stonewall Jackson, well, I would imagine there would be problems. Same name, just, you know. So anyhow, man, is it humid there. I went out the first morning I was there, and I, you know, it's humid, but, you know, so I'm right at sunrise, I'm running, and felt pretty good, you know, so I went ahead and went a full 5K out and turned around. And then it hit me. Oh, my goodness. By the time I got back, oh, the humidity. It was like running through soup. It really, really was. It was rough. It would be hard to live with that kind of humidity. And we got some real rockin' rainstorms while I was there, too. But they would last for like 35 seconds and then start up again 2 minutes later. It was sort of weird how that worked. Anyway, the first night we did an event at Gordon Conwell's campus there in Jacksonville. And it was basically a discussion between Dr. Brown and myself on how we've managed to work together as well as debate each other over the years, and to have such a close friendship with one another in the process. And I'm a little surprised. I think it's because other stuff's going on right now. I'm a little surprised there hasn't been, you know, just 47,000 nasty articles and videos and everything else on the net about that particular discussion. We got into all sorts of stuff, and there was a good group there. They really seemed to enjoy the exchange, the give and take, the back and forth. And I think what made it especially useful was if you were there for that discussion where we talked about a lot of our differences and yet what binds us together in our devotion to Christ and his truth and his gospel. We got to flesh out the next night. Now, some people have said about the debate, well, that wasn't fair. It's sort of like, you know, when I debated this one fellow in South Africa, some of the Muslims afterwards, like, well, that wasn't fair. The Muslim guy wasn't able to even compete. You know, why did you pick him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the reality is trying to find meaningful debate partners, opponents on that subject is extremely difficult. When I was first contacted and asked, would you be willing to come do this? I'm like, well, yeah, but I'll be perfectly honest with you. I'm highly skeptical that even if you find two people that would say they'd be willing to do this, I think such pressure would be put on them over time that they would withdraw. I just can't see this happening. And what's interesting is one of the original two people did withdraw, just as I predicted, and for pretty much the reasons I predicted. And but Chris Arnton kept pushing on, and the head, the moderator of the Metropolitan Community Church, suggested Ruth, the female debater. And so I was just thankful that there was any discussion at all, because I was of the opinion that there was a very high possibility, even a probability, that the whole thing would fall apart and it wouldn't even take place. So it did. And what was, for me anyway, the highlight of that evening was, in fact, the demonstration that the Trinity debate that took place now, not sure how many years ago, where Michael and I debated two Unitarians, Anthony Buzzard and Joseph Good, as I recall their names, on the doctrine of the Trinity, that was not a fluke. Now, Michael and I had no, you know, before we did that debate, we had maybe exchanged a few emails. We saw each other in the makeup room beforehand because it was a television thing, so you had to put makeup on. I hate that. But we were going to be under television lights, so I guess if you don't want to look like a corpse, you've got to do that. So that was the only time we spent together before the debate. And yet, the common comment for years now, as people have viewed that, was just couldn't believe how you guys were finishing each other's sentences, and you just work hand in glove. It just didn't seem fair. In fact, during the break, I went out, and Summer was in the audience for that debate, and she was like, "I sort of feel bad for the heretics." I'm like, "No, don't feel bad for the heretics." The same thing happened in the debate on Saturday night. We did purposefully ask to stay seated for the rebuttal period so that we could sort of do a free flow, work off of each other, you know, type of a response. And that went really, really well. That was, in fact, someone came up to me the next day and said, it sounded like you all had scripted that and had memorized your parts. And we didn't. It was just, I'd go for a minute and then pick up the sentence there, and he'd go for a minute. And it wasn't just a minute, but just to a place of logical break and just flowed for 15 minutes. Back and forth. And then we'd, like, for example, during the cross-examination, we could just simply glance at each other and who wants that one? And it would just be you take it. Oh, okay, I'll take it, you know. Because we know each other's areas and what, you know, might be a person's strongest response or something like that. And so... Yeah, the other side did not present much of an argument. I mean, a lot of people say, Ruth and Naomi, what? Look, if you've read as much as Michael and I have read in the other side's literature, you've heard all that stuff before. I think time only kept Dwayne from going to... Dave and Jonathan, at that point, he didn't want to talk about the Old Testament. I don't know which, but, yeah, we've heard all that before. We were prepared for the centurion's, pice, and, Michael has read, I think, probably a little more literature than I have, not by much, when new books come out, I'll contact him. Have you seen this? And sometimes yes, sometimes no. It all depends. And it's not fun having to read all that stuff, but you sort of have to keep up with it a little bit. But we were able to present a very, very clear presentation of the gospel and of the biblical perspective on human sexuality, homosexuality, and things like that. So now I felt badly for Michael. He actually had to check out of the hotel because I went back to the hotel at night and I did two services at Switzerland Community. And by the way, I linked, I don't think I linked on the blog or on, not sure if it was Facebook. But I did two sermons. They were supposed to be the same sermon, but Jake there at the church actually floated the idea of posting both of them. They don't normally only post one of the two. But they ended up being rather different in order of presentation and emphasis and stuff like that. And that, you know, sometimes happens when you preach a sermon. And I did not have an outline, didn't have a single word of notes. Ephesians 2 was my only notes. And so that can result in you going different directions each time you do it. Anyway, but it has been posted on YouTube, the sermons. But, excuse me, Michael, see, I'm just thinking about poor Michael. I started getting tired. Michael had to drive to Vero Beach that night. 3 hours. A 3 hour drive after the debate. He left probably 9:30. That means he probably got to bed around 1 and then had multiple services the next morning. So that was pretty rough. I wouldn't have wanted to have done something like that. But anyway, so the debate has already been posted, I believe. I imagine we will get links to it eventually, and put it into the Alpha and Omega Ministries stuff on homosexuality on the web and things like that. But it was a wonderful opportunity. I think it was very, very clear. I'm not claiming the other side made much of a argument, but I think most people today would be more influenced by the emotional arguments coming from, especially Ruth, than we might wish. So I think it was useful along that line. So hopefully that was helpful to you. I saw a lot of people afterwards, very thankful for all the people who afterwards were saying, wow, you know, that was really encouraging. I was there, or watching you and Michael working together was just wonderful, or whatever else it might be. We did see those things, even though we were busy and then traveling back on Sunday. You know, my initial flight out of Jacksonville got pushed back by hours, and so I had to reroute and do all that type of stuff. And thanks to American Airlines for getting me back even earlier than I would have anyways. And I only had to wait one day for my bag, but they got me where I needed to go. So I appreciate that. So it was a good weekend. My thanks to everybody there at Switzerland Community Church. They discovered how much work it really is to put something like that together. And and of course, you have Chris Arnzen at the beginning of the debate commenting, because the comment had already been made. Maybe, I don't think when he was there, but did you notice the sort of Japanese looking folding type background behind where the debate took place? Well, they do that because there's a bunch of musical instruments and a huge drum kit and stuff like that back there. And so rather than just having that as your background, they put that thing up. Well, it does look a little Japanese, you know? And so of course, Chris can't resist it. And comes up with something about, and all, you know, he's talking about thanking all the people that were involved, and thanks to such and such Japanese sushi restaurant or something like that for the background and stuff like that. And it was hilarious, you know. I'm sure Chris could have gone for another 20 minutes. Probably had all that information just in the back of his head, just ready to go. Waiting for Twitter to explode. Yeah, no. Also, now I just looked over. Kofi says, makes sense now. Sheologians is definitely lit. Wow. Okay. Whatever. Okay. I will try to not use it anymore, at least today, because I would imagine if you use lit too many times in the same episode, you might cause a fire, which could. Yeah, I didn't get to really see it. Yeah. Is lit. There I go. Yep. Who has the time? I mean, apparently Rodrigo Gonvaz, Rod or somebody, has the time to screen cap and is lit right across my forehead. That's good. Anyway. All right. So one last thing here. We'll probably go just a little bit over an hour. That's a wonderful thing. I was telling Michael, because I was also on Line of Fire, and people like to say that when I'm on, it becomes the dividing line of fire. So it's sort of a mixed thing. But we did a live thing where, again, you know, taking calls, and Michael has the same screening thing that we've got, except there's like 25 lines in it. I'm sorry? It is. Yeah, it's a portable one. And so we were taking calls from folks, and again, vast majority of the calls were answering the exact same way, feeding off one another. Even when someone calls up and tries to divide the two of us, you know, we handle it really well. It was really enjoyable. That's available out there too. I forgot to mention that particular one, if you want to bring that up. But what I mentioned to Michael when I was on was, you know, the nice thing is the dividing line. You do it when you want to do it. You do it for as long as you want to do it. And you don't have to worry about watching that clock, and you don't have to have music coming up and all the rest of that stuff. And it might not reach as wide an audience. Then again, we might. But you can talk about what you need to talk about when you need to talk about it. And that's a neat thing. Speaking of which, the plan is that we will, be doing another program tomorrow instead of Thursday, because I'll just be straightforward with you. If I don't go out Thursday night, to a high altitude place of darkness, to try to get some more pictures of the Milky Way and maybe of the Andromeda Galaxy, maybe of Albireo, I won't have a chance to do it again, thanks to travel and the moon, until November. And I've been putting stuff together for months, and so this is my one shot. The weather's going to be okay, not perfect, but okay. And so I need to get out there where it's totally dark, and hopefully get some really neat pictures of the Milky Way and a few other things in the process. It's just, people say, why do you do stuff like that? It's beautiful. It's fantastic. It's awesome. It's part of God's creation, and I live in a city where you don't get to see it. And then once you find out it's up there, you start realizing, hey, you know what? I can actually locate the exact center of our galaxy, where there is a supermassive black hole, Sagittarius A star, stuff like that. I realize, you know, I know some folks I try to get them excited about, and they're sort of like, they just don't care. Yeah, if you're satisfied with just looking at this one little planet, and there's a whole lot more out there, that's up to you. Anyway, so we will be doing the program tomorrow, maybe we'll just open the phone lines over and up then, and go from there tomorrow. But I was highly tempted to do a full response to Jamar Tisby and the Drop the Mic guys. But as I said, they decided to break it up into multiple parts. What happened was, once I read the article that was put up on September 6th, battle lines form over social justice. Is it gospel or heresy? By Jamar Tisby. And on social media, I got in contact with, I think the other gentleman, I'm thinking that it was the other gentleman that was actually on the program today. When I listened today. The program was yesterday. Or at least it was posted yesterday. And was basically told, no, we're not interested in dialoguing with you. We're not interested in coming on the program. Not interested in talking about these things. We've said what we need to say. And that's it. Well, here's the problem. There were a number of things said in the course of the article. What really, really interests me is there is a section in the statement on social justice, not just a statement on social justice, but it's the one we're talking about, that says, quote, "We affirm that some cultures operate on assumptions that are inherently better than those of other cultures because of the biblical truths that inform those worldviews that have produced these distinct assumptions." Now, I'll be honest with you. I didn't write those words, but I read those words in the cooperative editing process. I may have suggested some edits to it or added a word. I don't remember. But it never struck me as anything other than a self-evident, obvious, duh statement. It needs to be said, but it's not debatable. It's just that obvious. And yet, there has been nothing that I've seen, nothing that I've seen, that has triggered the social justice mindset of so many than that statement. I mean, it's almost like God providentially put it in there as a big, huge spotlight that just turns on and tells you, as someone reads this, who the folks are that have been deeply influenced by extra biblical categories of thought, as Samuel Say outlines in the article. Jamar Tisby responds to it by saying, "The best word to describe the assertion above is ethnocentric." He repeated that on the program. Ethnocentric. Let me repeat it again, and let me see if you can find where the ethno is. Okay? "We affirm that some cultures operate on assumptions that are inherently better than those of other cultures because of the biblical truths that inform those worldviews that have produced these distinct assumptions." So all it is a statement. It's a simple biblical statement that every Christian should just go, yeah, duh. That is simply stating that the more closely one culture's laws and beliefs align with biblical revelation, the better off they'll be. And the farther away, the more rebellious, the more you suppress the light, the worse you'll be. But you see, if you don't have a biblical worldview, but you think you have a biblical worldview, but what you actually have is like a neo-Marxist worldview, but you don't know that. You call it something else. You call it a biblical worldview, but it didn't come from the Bible. It didn't come from that context. It's come from other stuff, and you've been told that's what it is. Then you hear that, and you go, there's not one culture better than another culture. Yes, there is. Yes, there is. Let me quote Jesus to you. When he talked about the cities of his day, Capernaum, for example, and then contrasted them with the cities of old, even Tyre and Sidon, Sodom and Gomorrah. Was there not a clear gradation in these even city-states as to how much revelation they had, what they did with that? The point was, great revelation given today, they reject the Son of God, it's going to be more tolerable for those other societies because of that suppression. Great light has come to Capernaum. Rejects it. Not much light back then. There will be a different standard of justice. Isn't that obvious? And so when you're talking about entire cultures, the more light you have that you then incorporate into the law and fabric of your society in obedience to God, that makes for a better society. But you see, the people of the world don't have a category for better society. I've heard people who are Christians not recognizing how deeply influenced they've been by a worldly worldview, saying, how dare anyone say that one society is better than another? God says it. It's obvious. The only reason that you go to war against Germany in World War II is because you're saying our way of doing things is better than your way of doing things. Isn't this obvious? Yes, it's very obvious. And that's how overwhelming of simple common sense this type of leftist reasoning can be, that you're triggered by the idea that a society that has more alignment with biblical revelation is better than a society that rebels against biblical revelation. That's all it is. It's not ethnocentric. It's theocentric, not ethnocentric. And if you think it's ethnocentric, I submit to you that your worldview has been deeply influenced by stuff that it shouldn't be influenced by as a Christian. Shouldn't be influenced by. Now, there's a lot more in, but, and this didn't come up on the program today. And so that's why I'm not playing it. But after that brief ethnocentric thing, where he says, who gets to decide which cultures and which assumptions are closer to biblical truth? Anybody reading a Bible? I mean, you look at a tribe that sacrifices their children to a hideous snake god, and then you look at a nation that takes seriously the word of God and protects their children, and I go, better. That's not ethnocentric, Jamar. That's common sense, Jamar. Real simple, real. I just don't even know how you'd even begin to defend something. I just don't know. I cannot imagine it. Did you really mean what you... For most American history, white Christians have claimed that privilege. That privilege is now being challenged. It has nothing to do with race. You are so locked into skin color categories that you can't get out of the box. It has nothing to do with it at all. Anyway, he says, I'm tempted to refute the recent statement on the gospel and social justice point by point. Really? Well, I'm glad that you are capable of engaging in that, showing how it falls short of the Bible's call for justice. But I think our time would be better spent on other pursuits. There's too much work to be done, work that will be delayed by endless debates. Yes, okay. I could refute you, but I'm too busy. Okay. Here's my advice, he says. Many of the people who authored and signed this statement have large ministries and platforms. Avoid them. Find other authors, preachers, and teachers from whom you can learn. People like Austin Channing Brown, or the podcasters and bloggers at Truth's Table, or The Witness, where I am a contributor. Or read Howard Thurman, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Brian Stevenson, James Baldwin, or the other writers who have explored issues of justice. If the supporters of statements that dismiss social justice as a distraction from the gospel headline a major conference, state your concerns to the organizers. If nothing changes, then don't go. If they do an interview on a podcast, find another episode to listen to. If they write more blogs, state their case, share other ones instead. So what do we hear? We could refute you, but you're not worth it. We're going to segregate from you. We're going to put you off in the corner. Now, we're not going to say you're not Christians, but we're going to treat you like you're not Christians. Because you see, one of the ways that we're treating them as Christians is that we're saying, how about giving us some biblical pushback, some biblical interaction, something that's other than 99% of what we've gotten so far, which is just hand-wringing, leftist, progressive, I can't believe you actually said that, you people are a bunch of slave owners, claptrap. It's just ridiculous. There's been almost no meaningful essence to what has been said. I mean, why doesn't somebody come to us with a Bible in their hand and a serious desire to exegete the text rather than, I'm triggered by this and I'm offended by that and blah, 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 blah. So you show that you believe someone's actually a Christian by actually challenging them. So I listened to their podcast today, and there were lots of things I wanted to point out where I'm like, did you hear what you just said here? You want to talk about my blind spots, but man, I listened to your side. You are not listening to the other side. And when you do, you know, like, if you obsess over the statement on social justice and the gospel as if that's some type of power trip, wow, those lenses are thick. I mean, I don't know how you don't run into walls wearing lenses that thick. So I'm trying to listen. I'm trying to hear. I mean, it never would have crossed my mind. And so I'm like, okay, that power thing, that power dynamics thing, you don't get that from the New Testament. You're not getting that from Paul, but you do get it from the stuff you're getting in your universities and stuff. And that does seem to indicate a few things. But I'm willing to have Jamar Tisby on. I'd love to have him explain how that statement is ethnocentric. But instead, what we get is, avoid them. Don't listen to them. Don't even listen to podcasts that they might be on. Don't read their books. Don't go to conferences. Just shun them. Self-segregate. And I'm sitting around going, we've said for a long time, it has something to do with, you know, causing division in the church. And here's one of the main leaders, and he's counseling, division in the church. That's what it is. That's what Kyle Howard was doing. And that's what Jamar Tisby's doing. And I don't think from what was said at the end of the podcast today that the next episode is going to change any of that. I have a feeling it's only going to expand upon that a good bit. So there you go. Avoid them. Avoid them. Don't listen. Don't listen to the other side. Don't listen to the other side. Just listen to ours. Oh, okay. There you go. There you go. All right, so maybe, I had said before we had to do the response last time, we're going to do something about open phones. Now I've said it again, so I suppose probably would be time to do some open phones tomorrow. So, yeah, I guess the same time is fine, 2 p.m., we'll do at least an hour worth of open phones. We'll see how the calls are going. And so we'll go with that from there. How's that sound? All right. So thank you for watching the program today. And Lord willing, we'll see you tomorrow afternoon. God bless.